I'm here on the job site with Dale, who's a framing contractor.
Hey, good morning.
Dale traded up to Geico Commercial Auto Insurance for all his business vehicles. We're here where he needs us most.
Yep, they sure are.
We make it easy for him to save on all his insurance needs, all in one place, with coverage that fits his business and bottom line. Oh, I shouldn't have looked down.
It's all right.
We're so far up here.
Look at me. Take a deep breath.
Oh, I'm good. So good.
Get a commercial auto insurance quote today at Geico.com and see how much you could save. Get more with Geico.
Finding great candidates to hire can be like, well, trying to find a needle in a haystack. Sure, you can post your job to some job board, but then all you can do is hope the right person comes along. Which is why you should try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them for you. Its powerful technology identifies people with the right experience and actively invites them to apply to your job. You get qualified candidates fast. So while other companies might deliver a lot of hay, ZipRecruiter finds you what you're looking for. The needle in the haystack.
See why 4 out of 5 employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free, at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. That's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter.com/zip.
This is Courtney Gray, Life and Body Coach. It is my pleasure to welcome you to another episode of the Road to Rediscovery podcast with Aubrey Johnson. Happy listening.
Our lives are laid out on a road of bumps, turns, struggles, and more. How do we respond? How do we endure adversity for learning and growth? I'm Aubrey Johnson, and we'll explore these questions and more on The Road to Rediscovery.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Road to Rediscovery. I'm your host, Aubrey Johnson. The Road to Rediscovery is about reflecting on life lessons to learn and grow from them, and of course, pay it forward and uplift others who are struggling through dark times. If you wish to connect with The Road to Rediscovery beyond the weekly episodes, I want to personally invite you to follow our Road to Rediscovery Facebook page. We are a collective positive vibe of 800 followers strong and growing, and we are chock full of thought-provoking, inspirational quotes, posts of positivity, solo guests, and video shorts, and a lot more. There's something for everyone on this page if you are seeking motivation and inspiration. Just search for the page R2R Podcast while on Facebook, select it, and click follow. And while you're there, if you feel you would recommend this show to someone, please click the reviews link to share your thoughts of the show. Again, that page name is R2R and Podcast. And I want to thank you in advance for growing the page, and always, always want to thank you for your listenership. All right. My guest has endured a long, long, hard road of mental illness and trauma. But in these experiences, he's also grown a passion for empowering others from what he's learned on his journey. He's a martial arts coach, a writer, a mental health advocate, having lived with bipolar disorder, CPTSD, and ADHD, having gone through divorce and multiple suicide attempts and ideation. He now forges the path of helping others navigate their dark waters. We're going to talk about his ups. We're going to talk about his downs and in-betweens, as well as his new book, Internal Jiu-Jitsu, How to Conquer Mind and Body Resistance by Giving Way. Ladies and gentlemen, get ready for a very impactful conversation as we welcome Mr. Julio Angel Rivera to the show. Julio, welcome to the show. It's so great to have you here, sir.
Hi, Aubrey. Thanks so much for having me. I'm very excited.
Oh, thank you, sir. We reciprocate. We're equally excited. And just want to ask if we can open up by, if you don't mind, sharing with us a glimpse of your journey and some of your early struggles with mental illness and trauma. Now, if I may ask, I'm going to ask if you can share whatever earlier struggles you've had before the divorce, because I'd like to get to that in its own entity real soon.
Right. Yeah. I grew up in a really volatile environment. It was a rough neighborhood, and there was a lot of violence and fighting every day, and there were knives and there were guns, and it was very scary. So every day when you would leave the house, you really wouldn't know what was going to happen. Every day there were fights at school. You didn't know if you were going to get jumped by a gang. The building where I lived was a haven for crack dealers, and it was the 80s, so it was the height of the crack epidemic. So the neighborhood was really ravaged by it. And when I was about 8 years old, I witnessed a murder just outside my building from my window. And the murderer was my best friend's father. And he never got punished for the murder. And I ended up still living with him in the same building for the next, you know, 7 or 8 years, and having to pass by him and knowing what kind of person he was and what he had done and the coldness of it. And ironically, he was supposed to be a kung fu master. So I was completely dumbfounded as to why he didn't use his kung fu. Instead, he just pulled out a knife and he stabbed the man in cold blood. So it really shook me up, and I watched the man die, and I called 911, even though I was just a little kid. But I felt like it was me there lying on the sidewalk. You know, I really felt like it felt like an out-of-body experience. So it shook me up for a long time. And from then on, I just remember having so much anxiety, particularly at school. I would have to have my dad come pick me up. I would feel physically ill, but it was because I didn't know how to respond to the anxiety I was feeling. I didn't know how to escape from the situation. So my only way of doing it was to be sick, was to be physically ill. And that's how life continued until I started getting therapy around the age of 12. I started therapy and lifting weights and writing all the same year when I was 12 years old. I really needed to express myself at that time. And I went through severe depression and severe anger issues because I was always on the defensive from being in that sort of environment. I was always prepared for something negative to happen. So I was on high alert all the time, and it made it difficult to relax, and it made it difficult to make friends. And it was impossible to feel comfortable anywhere in any environment, whether I was in my own neighborhood, which I hated, of course, and I wanted to get out of. Whether I was with friends who were who lived in different environments, because I always felt like an outsider there, you know. So I didn't really know where I fit in, but I know I wanted to escape. So it took me getting robbed at gunpoint just around the just around the corner from where I lived when I was 13. And several other incidents that leading up to a shootout when I was 16, just outside our building, where we all had to jump behind the car, the entire family. And at that point, my dad agreed that he would move us out of the neighborhood. After we've been begging for years. So we finally got out of that environment, but, that didn't mean that it was out of me. You know, I was still feeling that kind of tension no matter where I was. Even though I was safe now, it didn't feel that way on the inside. So I had started lifting weights at 12, and I developed into a bodybuilder, and I started competing as a teenager. So I was developing this outside facade that would protect me from people and would keep people from bothering me because they were, because I looked like I was tough, and that's really what I wanted back then. Even though I great on the inside. And then when I finally retired from bodybuilding, that's when I started doing martial arts, and I threw myself into that. And again, I wanted to become this impenetrable kind of fortress that couldn't be messed with because I was so afraid all the time. So I trained my butt off in martial arts, and I got good, and I earned a few black belts, and I still found that I had this internal fear that I didn't quite conquer yet. So it took some really deep therapy and getting in touch with who I was and meditation and medication eventually. To finally get stable and try to figure out, you know, what my place is in this world. So,
wow, my goodness. I mean, what visibility you've had to some very traumatic experiences. I mean, especially as a child where, you know, it's a scene that no child should ever be put in a position to see. a human being dying right in front of them. Now, just for my clarity, you mentioned it was your best friend's father that committed the murder?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, I got you. Man, I mean, yeah, what a traumatic experience. What an ordeal. My goodness. And gunpoint, being held at gunpoint at 13 is, again, something that no young person, no person, no human period should ever have to, experience, you know. And how do you process all that? Even though you're physically moved out of that neighborhood, that's hard to do. And one thing you mentioned that I thought was at least a safe haven for you for that time was lifting weights and writing. You know, these are creative outlets, you know, that you can have to help establish some form of stability, some form of comfort, you know, in doing something that is creative, that is productive, that encourages and helps your body, encourages and helps your mind with writing, you know. But it seemed to be, while these are outlets, you still had the trauma and the mental illness plaguing you inside, which I guess, you know, goes beyond the creative outlets where you addressed with therapy and meditation and medicine, right?
Yeah, you know, for a long time, the bodybuilding in particular, it helped take my mind off the depression a lot of the time, because it gave me discipline and focus, and it put me in my body, you know, and took me out of that thinking loop that I was in so much of the time. Mm-hmm. Gave me a purpose. It allowed me to transform myself into something else. So it made me feel powerful in that sense. Something that I didn't feel in my own neighborhood. You know, I felt rather helpless. So bodybuilding really saved me, just like writing about all the sadness kept me from expressing it in other ways and possibly negative ways.
Right. Yeah. And writing about the sadness, that's a form of processing too. Is that correct?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, writing the first draft of my first book, I wrote by hand, and I wrote it in a handwriting that I can't read, so that I couldn't go back and read it. I just wanted it to be pure emotion so that I could start to process what I had been through without overthinking it, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. No, I got it. For sure. Wow. Again, very mind blowing. Very, very mind blowing. And obviously, you know, getting several black belts and, you know, having therapy and meditation and martial arts has its own virtues, in which you've mentioned that you've learned how to get within yourself, within your body, within your mind, at one with yourself and with your mind, to kind of temporarily squash that noise, I guess, mm-hmm. so to speak. So that you can focus on martial arts or focus on being present and those sorts of things. You know, principles and virtues that are still quite valid and very much used to this day. Julio, I wanted to talk with you then about, as you started to enter adulthood, right? As you said, you at some point retired from bodybuilding and you took on martial arts and got some black belts and so forth. And then going into adulthood, these things, I guess they don't go away easily, right? So you're still processing, probably still going to therapy and so forth. And you become a husband, you become a father, right? And what was that experience like for you, in early adulthood?
I was first of all, I was deathly afraid of becoming a dad. Like, I had decided that I didn't want to be a father, and my ex-wife, we were on the same page originally. Mm-hmm. And then she changed her mind and she convinced me, and it's the greatest decision I've ever made, of course. But I was afraid of being a dad because I didn't want to pass on mental illness to my child, number one. And number two, I didn't want my kid to see the kind of stuff that I saw and go through that kind of stuff and have to deal with the heavy weight of that as a young kid. I guess I had a hard time seeing my child having a different childhood from me. So it was a hard decision to go ahead with it. Of course, I'm glad I did. I wasn't the only person in that neighborhood that suffered. That's one of the things that I think about a lot when I talk about my own situation. I mean, there were families next door that had loved ones killed, you know. It's just when a lot of Mexican families were coming into the neighborhood and they were the victims of so much crime at the hands of the people that were already there. It was really rough to see, you know. A neighbor of a really good friend of our family, he was in the Marine Corps. He was like the pride of the neighborhood.
Warning, the following ZipRecruiter radio spot you are about to hear is going to be filled with F-words.
When you're hiring, we at ZipRecruiter know you can feel frustrated, forlorn even, like your efforts are futile, and you can spend a fortune trying to find fabulous people, only to get flooded with candidates who are just fine. Fortunately, ZipRecruiter figured out how to fix all that. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. With ZipRecruiter, you can forget your frustrations because we find the right people for your roles fast, which is our absolute favorite F word. In fact, 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day.
Fantastic.
So, whether you need to hire 4, 40, or 400 people, get ready to meet first-rate talent. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/zip to try ZipRecruiter for free. Don't forget, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. Finally, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip.
But he was murdered in a park nearby defending a young lady.
Come on.
There were all these things, you know. I had an uncle murdered. So it wasn't just me. It was a neighborhood of trauma. You know, it was a community of trauma. But much like other people that are suffering with trauma, I didn't realize how much it had affected me until I was married. And my wife, who's a social worker, my ex-wife, she pointed out to me that a lot of what I was doing, a lot of my behavior was connected to my trauma, and I resisted what she was saying. I hadn't seen a good psychiatrist up to that point, and I dismissed it. I dismissed what she was saying, and I staunchly defended my family and the job they did raising me, despite all the clues that there were all these abusive tactics used, and not even intentionally. It was just the way they were brought up, and the things they did were abusive, for, you know, there's no other way to put it. But I know that they didn't have any bad intent. They just didn't know any better. So there are all these fears that I built up that were clearly connected to my upbringing, and my ex-wife helped me see that and helped me find my way to help and find a good doctor. And that's kind of what opened the door for me to get better.
I see. So leading up to that point, Julio, I mean, was what she was describing, I guess, some sort of subconscious repressing of what you've been going through? Downplaying your trauma, but repressing it to try to function for today.
I think more than repressing it, I was expressing it in unhealthy ways. I was expressing it through anger. before that, I used to party a lot and do lots of party drugs and try to just take my mind to another place. You know, I'd become obsessive about bodybuilding and obsessive about martial arts and push myself as much as I could. And I would find these sort of distractions from my own mind. But I just, I couldn't outrun it. Eventually, no matter what I was doing, it would catch up to me. And I could be, you know, with bipolar disorder, you can feel like the king of the world one day, and the next day you just feel like the biggest piece of garbage on earth, you know? And it's tough to think of the other state of mind when you're in one place. So you forget that everything is temporary, and you forget that eventually you'll get better. And, you know, to my ex-wife's credit, she was persistent. She knew I needed help, and a big thing was that I was expressing my trauma as anger, you know, because I was so defensive, because I was so afraid, I would lose my temper quite a bit when I felt like I was being assaulted in some way verbally, or when my opinion was being challenged, or, you know, just the unnecessary moments. And it wasn't frequent, but they were explosive, situations. You know, my doctor called it intermittent explosive disorder, where about four times a year I would have an incident that would make people cry and shudder in fear, you know? And to me, it was just me expressing anger, because it was what I saw at home. I saw anger expressed that way in my home. So to me, it was completely normal. But to the person I was expressing it to, who hadn't seen anger like that, it was completely shocking and scary. And, you know, I can see that today, and I have empathy for them now.
Yeah, no, I completely understand. And your ex-wife helped you see it, which is absolutely tremendous, because, you know, it starts with us, right? I mean, everyone around us can say or see that it's quite obvious. You have a problem, you need to see someone, get professional help. But if we don't see it for ourselves, then, you know, no foundation for progress is ever made, right? So, you know, my background is talent development. And one of the things that in one of the classes I teach, that is a mantra that we always say is, if you don't talk it out, whether you know it or not, you will act it out. Mm-hmm. So that is what kind of popped into my head as you were talking about, you know, the clubbing, the partying, you know, the drugs, or just, you know, just getting in, burying yourself in the weights, you know, and the weightlifting and so forth as a distraction, or it's a behavioral type of coping mechanism to act it out, since it's not being talked out. But I appreciate you sharing and being quite candid with sharing that that experience for sure, Julio. I wanted to ask you, there's a couple questions I wanted to ask you, okay? And this is coming up to the divorce and the suicide attempts. And I want to see if we can, and I know we can't do this in one conversation, but just maybe kind of take a slight dive into the mindset of someone who may have suicidal ideation. I am a loved one who, or lost a loved one from suicide years ago. And so I've always wondered about this, and maybe you can share some insight from your journey. And the first thing I wanted to ask you is, when it came to your divorce and the ideation that you started to have, first off, did that happen before you got married, or did it happen after the series of suicide ideation? Did that happen or start to happen after, or once you become, you learned of, you know, your wife wanting a divorce?
No, it happened pretty early on. I remember telling my first visit to a psychiatrist when I was 12. I remember telling him, I'm afraid I'm going to hurt someone or hurt myself.
Okay.
So I was already kind of feeling that. Sense that I should punish myself or I should end my own life. And then in my early, my mid 20s, I went through another, that was the first time I attempted, it didn't happen again until my 40s. So
I see. Typically speaking, Julio, when someone, who was your age early on, is subject to all of these traumatic experiences, death, having their death or their life and their own mortality, like on, you know, at the tip of a gun being pointed at them, you know, as a child, you know, and having these types of experiences, is it the way it impacts you, does it impact you in such a way that there's a triggering event or a pivotal event that causes a spiral, a downward spiral, or is it a steady decline as you go through, you know, one event after another, or even if there's like weeks or months between events, you know, you still have, you know, these mental thoughts. It's hard to kind of ask that question, but between an event triggering spiral or a steady decline, which is more, sounds more practical in terms of this journey before transformation happens?
So I would say it was gradual early on, just because it just felt like what life was, you know. Living in a traumatic area, a traumatic situation, and just dealing with the madness that went on where I lived, it felt like that's just what we dealt with. You know, oh, someone got killed next door last night. Oh, you know, I'm not surprised. I mean, I remember I looked up on the internet, I looked up a bunch of newspapers to try to find the murder that I witnessed, and there were so many murders on that block.
Oh my goodness!
That I couldn't make it back past like 1992 or something. It was just too much. It was insane, and it was that concentrated area, you know.
Yeah.
So it was shocking how little it had changed.
That's very shocking. I mean, and trying to find the one that you witnessed within a pool of dozens others.
So
that gives great perspective on the situation that in which you were living in and enduring. So again, thank you for that. And trust me, there's a method behind this question that I just asked, for the listeners' benefit, people who are going through tough times, people who are at their wits' end, not quite sure where to turn, who to turn to. You know, I want them to understand the levity of what you have experienced so they can see to themselves that they're not alone in their struggles. Okay. And you're giving them a sense of hope by sharing this transparently. And in a minute, we're going to get to just some of the good work that you're doing in helping other people. But again, thank you for sharing that, Julio. So if you don't mind, I'd like to ask you a two-part question, okay? And again, I know in this conversation we're not going to solve this, but any insights you have would be greatly appreciated. The first question I wanted to chat about is from a first-person perspective, okay? The person in which hurts, the one in pain, the one traumatized, the one who feels the world would be at a better place if they weren't around. Okay. This person. So, and this may be totally false, but what I've heard in, you know, over the years is that when a person is contemplating suicide, they're not always vocal about it, you know, or they're not vocal at all in a lot of cases. So there's a sense of, in some cases, numbness or indifference to everything around them, as if nothing, you know, matters enough to make them reconsider. I don't know. We talked about repression, and you know, I've heard that for those who have it so repressed when around loved ones, you know, that they need to wear a mask to kind of repress, or a mask, you know, while they're around loved ones until those dark moments where they're finally alone, and then these bad thoughts, dark thoughts, just creep into their head. Can you share some insight on that? Is that accurate? Is that way off base? How much of that is true? And you know, and when you're alone in there in those four walls, and you're being overtaken by these dark thoughts, you know, what's going through your head at those times?
Yeah, you know, the thoughts can be there even in a room full of people, and you'll be wearing that facade that you talked about, and just kind of keeping it all in, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, I had so many parties as a kid, where family parties, where I was extremely depressed and feeling suicidal, and everyone was partying around me, and they could see that I was sad, but it was just like, oh, that's just the way he is, you know, let's just let him be. So that was just the role that I played. But for me, suicidal ideation, like, comes down to hopelessness, you know. You just feel like there's zero hope that things are going to get better. And it's the only way that you see out of it. Yeah. For me, the only thing I believe that has kept me here is my daughter. The many, many, many times that I've considered taking my own life, she's the one that has kept me from moving forward and doing it, you know? I don't know what I would have done without her. I don't think that I would be here, because I couldn't think of another thing worth living for besides her, you know? So,
Man, Julio, that sends goosebumps down my back. Okay. And it literally does.
Saving money right now at Menards. From smoke and carbon monoxide detectors to fire extinguishers and more, Kidde Home Safety products keep your family protected in case of emergencies. Smoke and carbon monoxide detectors are perfect for your living spaces, offering protection and peace of mind. Save big money on all Kidde products at Menards. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now. Save big money at
Menards. And that prevents me from having to ask the second question or a follow-up question I had, which was something that, to be quite frank, I struggled with, right? Those who have suicidal ideations may get to the point where they're indifferent or numb, or think that nothing else in this world really matters to make them consider otherwise, right? And so the part I was struggling with is, during a time, if I understand correctly, during the time of one of your suicidal ideations, you wrote a long note to your daughter, and your daughter does matter, because that's why you're here today, as you said. Okay. But you were having that ideation at the time you were writing the letter. And I think the way you so eloquently articulated of how she is your reason to live, she's the one who got you out of this, in knowing as a parent that I have to be there and live for my daughter, you know, that just makes the question moot, right? I mean, it's like, okay, yes, I had the ideation as if nothing mattered, but guess what? Something does matter. It's my daughter. That's why I'm here today. So, I'm glad you brought that in. And so now, with that, if you don't mind, I'd like to pivot to the perspective of a loved one. Okay. My heart really breaks when something happens, the unmentionable, and there are loved ones around that would either say, oh, they're just like that, or I wish they would have came to me, you know, or talked to me. They know they can talk to me. And it's the root cause is a lot deeper than that in some cases, you know? Yeah. And so how can we as loved ones be proactive for telltale signs, or how do we keep the dialogue open? Okay. Because in my view, I can't help but think that unless someone is an educated, trained professional, no one on the outside, quote unquote, can kind of relate to someone going through that ideation, except for one who's experienced that ideation themselves. You know, that is the deepest form of empathy, I think. Someone who has actually gone through those thoughts and attempts to talk to someone who's going through them now. With that said, you have loved ones who want to say the right things. They don't quite know what to say. You have loved ones who, some loved ones just want to be the answer or find the answer, you know, and maybe them finding the answer or being the answer is not what's needed. But in the work that you do, in helping people struggling through this ideation, do you also do work with the impacted loved ones who want to reach out, who want to help, who want to talk to them, but just don't know what to say or how to approach it?
Yeah, you know, I get contacted by readers of my articles, often family members that talk about that I've given them kind of a new perspective and helped them see it through the eyes of their loved one. It's really impossible to convey to someone that hasn't had suicidal ideation what it's like, because, you know, I mean, it amazes me when I meet people that haven't thought about it, because it's been so common in my life.
Yeah.
And so to talk to someone is tough because most people, even if they don't intend it, they're very judgmental. And the first thing you need is someone that's not going to judge you when you talk to them about it. You know, some people will think that you're weak because you have those thoughts. Some people think that you're just a quitter, you know. I had a friend who I opened up to during my last period of suicidal ideation. Mm-hmm. And he said to me, you know, Julio, you're not special. If you're going to do it, just do it and don't talk about it. Mm. Now, I would have taken this way worse if his mom hadn't committed suicide herself when he was a child, you know.
Right.
So who knows how that has affected him and the way that he responded to me, you know.
Yeah.
But once he said that to me, I knew, okay, I can't talk to him about it ever again. Mm-hmm. So there are very few people. For me, it's my ex-wife, my therapist, and my psychiatrist. It's those three people.
Gotcha.
Because the other people in my life, even if they don't judge, it's going to be too painful for them. You know, they're going to be listening with emotion purely, and they're not going to really be able to give me any kind of, you know, maybe if it's not even advice, just the kind of the ear that I need, they're going to be listening from a position of either as a parent or a sibling that loves me and would be completely hurt and torn apart by me doing something like that. They'd be thinking about themselves rather than the pain that I would be going through, you know? I had a friend that went through with it a couple of years ago. And I often think about his very, very last moment, you know, and he had a couple of kids that he loved more than anything in the world. Mm-hmm. And I know that for him to be in that kind of pain, it must have been completely unbearable because he would never have wanted to leave his kids, you know? So it's impossible to convey that to somebody.
So Julio, I mean, would this be something considered to be a disease, something chronic like this? Like you said, your friend loved his kids more than anything in the world. And, you know, what was plaguing him was just so powerful to where he proceeded to go through with it, you know, and it doesn't mean he loved his kids any less or they were any less meaningful. No, they were absolutely, you know, the shining light in his life, I'm sure. But what had a hold on him was just so, so unforgiving and dark and oppressive. I don't know. To me, that's a sign of a disease. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, there's so many. If you talk about clinical depression, it's certainly a disease. And there's so many disorders that can drive people to taking their own lives. You know, bipolar disorder has a very high percentage of people who do take their own lives. And it's tough to fight with yourself every day, constantly. It's tough to try to take control of your mind when you know it's rebelling against you. When you feel hopeless, like I know my friend did, he felt he had no escape from the situation he was in. You've got to be, I mean, it's the ultimate commitment, isn't it?
It really is. Yeah, it is the ultimate commitment and a point of no return, for sure. Julio, I wanted to talk to you about the term or the phrase product of your environment, okay? We grow up over time and from what society puts on us as societal pressures, try to say that, hey, we're defined by our family. We're defined by where we live. We're defined by what type of career we have. We're defined by what we drive, the clothes we wear, and all this stuff, right? And it's all these societal pressures that are put on us as humans, you know, whether we recognize it or not. And again, this is in my view, okay? But for someone to say they're a product of their environment, I don't know how valid that is, right? And that's what I'm kind of struggling with, because it almost seems as if you're putting limitations on yourself if you say that you are a product of your environment. And I'm asking you this, Julio, because, again, for the benefit of the listeners, you know, I don't want the listeners to think that, you know, from the environment in which they've came from, in which they've encountered and navigated through so many traumas, you know, that doesn't define who they are today. Just because they're processing and going through traumas from that time, they're not a product of that environment. You know, this is something they're processing to get past, but it doesn't define who they are. Can you share some insights on that that would benefit the listeners in reassuring them that, you know, they are worthy, they are validated, you know, to be anything they want to be, and not to limit themselves by thinking they're a product of their environment from having endured those traumas?
Yeah, I mean, while they may not be a product of their environment, they're going to get affected by their environment in some way. And I think it's important to, rather than feel like a victim, to say that I want to examine what it was that affected me so that I understand why I react and respond the way that I do to things, and so that I can make better decisions, so that I know when I'm being triggered and I'm reacting as I am, as I would be back then. So I can tell myself that I'm safe and I don't have to be defensive. I mean, there's so many reasons to look back at what you've gone through and to work through your trauma, other than just the point fingers. we're all able to overcome where we came from. It's just a matter of what we do with the information that we have. You know, are we going to be bitter about it, or are we going to make a change?
Yes, 100%. That's in line. That's in line with what I had another guest tell me a while ago, who said, you know, the past does not have to define us, but if we have the courage to revisit and reflect and process, it can refine us. You know, yeah. So, again, very, very impactful. Man, Julio, I appreciate you sharing those insights of, you know, being affected by the traumas from that environment, but also, you know, just reemphasizing the importance of having that bravery to, you know, to go back and to look at it, to crack it open, and to refuse to be a victim. Don't play the victim card. Don't view yourself as a victim. You just willfully say, I want to examine what happened to me and why it made me or affected me this way. That's huge. It shows that in and of itself, before you even process and go through and be on the other side for reform, that in and of itself is maturity and the foundation for maturity to go to move in the right direction. So very insightful advice. Insightful words from you, Julio, for the listeners' benefit, and how to approach something like traumatic experiences of our childhood. So, Julio, this has been an absolute wonderful, wonderful conversation. We barely scratched the surface, I know, but I would love it if you can share with us, how can the listeners connect with you more? How can they learn more about your great work, pick up copies of your books, and just pick up more, you know, anecdotal insights from your books? How can they connect and learn more about you?
Sure. Well, my latest book is Internal Jiu-Jitsu, Conquering Mind and Body Resistance by Giving Way. And it's available at Amazon, barnesandnobles.com, books.org, or you can order from your local bookstore. My first book, Broke Down Sensei, is also on Amazon, and it talks about my journey with bipolar disorder and trauma. You can find me at my website, internaljujitsu.com, or on Instagram at internaljujitsu, and the same on Facebook, Internal Jiu-Jitsu.
Wonderful. Fantastic. Well, Julio, we're going to have links to all of those, your social media handles, your website, and links to purchase a copy of your book, your latest book, as well as Broken Sensei, your first book. We'll have those links in the episode show notes so the listeners can click those links and get to those resources while listening to this wonderful conversation. Julio, I can't thank you enough for coming on the show, my friend. It's been an absolute delight talking with you, learning about you, and just sharing your journey with us for the listeners' benefit, so people can understand that, you know, there is a way out and they are not alone. Julio, I hope we can stay in touch and maybe bring you back on the show at a future date, but I really appreciate you coming on the show, sir.
Absolutely. Thank you, Aubrey. It's been my pleasure.
Thank you. We reciprocate. I want to thank you for tuning in and listening. And look, you may feel like this at times, but in our daily struggles and adversities, we're not alone. Hope is always around the corner. And I humbly ask that you please share this show with someone you know, someone you love, who needs motivation, inspiration, and support. And when it all comes down to it, you know, we're all just roadies on this journey of life. But it feels good having you right alongside me. Thank you for listening. We'll chat again soon. We really hope you enjoyed this episode of The Roads Rediscovery. We'd love to hear from you. Shoot us an email at roadsrediscoverypodcast@gmail.com and leave us any questions or comments you may have. The Roads Rediscovery is an AJ Shark production.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting six crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus four biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.